modernizations. Okay, so go ahead.
So a couple of people did modernizations of the turnstile. Okay, or non-dialect versions. Okay, go for it.
Okay, it's 45 lines. It's a little long. The turnstile. We really thought we were clever sticking it to the man, I guess. Whoever we thought the man was. I could have sworn I saw your smirk tauntingly in the reflection as you walked behind me, half trying to conceal your pride until you returned to my side after we passed the turnstile. We always moved together with a kind of synchronicity that boasted to all around us, yes, that's right, we've done this before. We've done this at DuPont, Tenley, Eastern, Greenbelt, Vernon, all with the MPD 3 feet away. It was our favorite game to play, us sneaking through the turnstile.
That's DC, right?
Yes. We'd saunter past the lost tourists and chuckle at their questions, but you would always pull out Flip Turn from our ears long enough to help, and then start the music again and be whisked away by August. The outside world became subdued. I noticed only our hands glued, proud we got through the turnstile. Fuck, I swear I feel you as I push through it again. But the announcer's voice drags me back here to warn me the stop is closed, that train is yet again behind, or to move, the doors are closing. These I don't think I ever heard, though I'm sure they always occurred, while you and I passed the turnstile. Today, I am too aware of the sounds of robotic tapping, the murmur of tired shuffling, the stuttered announcements muffling, the sharp gasp escaping me now, as the turnstile is cloudy and gray, faded from daily abuse, questioning how I ever saw your smile reflected as we went through the turnstile.
Oh, I like the rhyme.
Great, yes. All right, that was wonderful. Did you like writing it?
Yeah.
Did you feel like you learned stuff writing it about the poem?
Yes, I had to reread the poem many, many times and come up with analogies that worked, so I took a lot of notes on it.
Yeah, that's great. Modern turnstiles. Nice, wonderful, good. Okay, Irina.
Oh, sorry. Mine's 34 lines, so I tried to keep it the same length as the turnstile and match the rhyme scheme and then where it was full stop.
Okay.
So, we'll see. In plastic yellow seats we met, always in a rush full of fret. As we rode at dawn each day, a friendship appeared underway. No longer gazing at the floor, we now smiled crossing through the door. And soon this became our routine, company complete with caffeine. From the corner cafe at bay, although it was out of our way, it made our morning moments shine as we got back on college line. But one day that paper presto prompted his decision to go. Away from the tracks, away now, he was ready to disavow. Then one by one to cars they went, away from queen and discontent. And now they wait in those parkades, which seem to be their new arcades. Our squad of six soon shrunk to three, and still dwindling, that's a decree. Asked for three loonies to borrow, and I knew she'd be gone tomorrow. Spent of the days we moved as one, fewer and fewer, approaching none. And when it was just you and I didn't want to say goodbye. So I missed my stop riding on, counting the hours till you'd be gone. Like rainwater in an eaves trough, our friendship was bound to run off. And so I crossed the gate again. Alone I waited for my train.
Nice. All right.
And then the other side's... I attempted to put in like Canadian pronunciations where I could.
Oh, okay. Let's get some examples.
So like again instead of again.
Uh huh.
So that rhymes with train.
Yes.
Whereas like again, and then tomorrow and borrow.
And borrow, yes.
And then just like the, yeah.
Okay.
Or
yeah.
Like words like eaves trough, which apparently people don't use here.
No, we say eaves. An eaves trough. Yeah. So we say gutter.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't know the word gutter?
I knew that. No, like a gutter's like by a street.
Yes. No, I see.
But
yeah.
Eaves trough is on a house.
On a house.
Yeah.
Yeah. So did people know that? No. No, but it's, you know, it's a Commonwealth language. Okay. That was great. Did you learn stuff doing it?
Yeah.
About the poem, about yourself, about life, about...
I think about the first poem, I think, the turnstile. It forced me to go back and look at what was happening kind of in each. Because I broke it down into sections.
Uh-huh.
and I to see what was happening, both like in terms of whatever like story, or in terms of what like the story is happening in the poem, and then also just like mechanically.
Yeah, so that's great. Okay, so just to remind you, this is being recorded, so if you don't want your poems like made public, let me know. It's okay with you? Okay with you? Okay, good. So I went back to get my computer and I left my book in my office, so I'm just going to get the scan, which is going to take a second. What did you all think of Barrett Browning?
My favorite.
Your favorite so far? That's great. How come?
I thought it was more accessible than most of the things we've read from the book so far. It didn't lose any of its intelligence just by being more accessible. And I think Barrett Browning finds much better use of real estate than a lot of like I think her, or maybe a more generous way of putting it is she like exceeds expectations when it comes to real estate in her poetry.
Okay, so much more going on line by line and verse by verse, much less repetition. Okay, good. What did other people think? She was, I should just tell you, she was the poet at the time. She's now no longer has quite the reputation that she did in her day. But in her day, her reputation was fantastically great, and you can see why. So what did other people think?
Aurora Leigh the poem that you said was inspired by Jane Eyre, or Jane Eyre was...
So it was inspired by Jane Eyre, at least if you were to read the whole thing, which you want to now, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Shall we just spend the next 3 weeks reading the whole thing? Blame them. If the answer is yes.
Well, I will say, I haven't read Jane Eyre, but I have read Emma, and I think Aurora Leigh herself is very Emma Woodhouse.
Okay, nice.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. Jane Eyre, just, how many people have read Jane Eyre? Do you like it?
Oh, I love it, yeah.
Do you like it?
Yes.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I mean, I prefer it to Wuthering Heights. So.
You prefer to Wuthering Heights?
I hate Wuthering Heights with a burning passion.
Okay, so that's actually praise for Wuthering Heights, because if you can hate a novel with a burning passion, that's not easy to do.
Yeah,
I mean,
it needs
basically
to be good enough for me to feel anything about it. So
Yeah. Okay. Other people have read Jane Eyre? So let me just say very quickly about Jane Eyre. I actually think Wuthering Heights is the greater novel, but that is saying a whole lot, because Jane Eyre is an amazing novel. Part of what makes it amazing is that the character of Jane, the narrator, is in no way a good girl. That is, that what you have is a first-person novel narrated by a woman. Those tended to be, especially, not only when written by women, but maybe especially when written by women, Victorian novels narrated by women tended to be kind of about saintly women who are dealing with a whole lot of, what is the word I'm looking for? Shit. Are dealing with it fairly well, and most of what they're dealing with is because of the stupidity of men. And the thing about Jane Eyre is she's doing the same thing, and it's because of the stupidity of men, among other reasons. But she is an impatient person. She is no saint. She is a person who, she actually has depth. What she isn't is an angel. So if you remember that we talked a little bit about the angel in the house, which is the Coventry, I don't know if you remember this, I said it in passing, but the Coventry Patmore, he's the person who did the poem, The Truth is Great and Will Prevail, when none care whether it prevail or not. But there is this idea of, let's say, the saintly woman who is being oppressed by modern society, by modern economics, by industrialization, and by greedy men. And there are tons and tons and tons of really great novels of that sort. You know, you can think of Edith Wharton as another person later who writes in that mode. Henry James often writes in that mode. But one of the surprising things about Jane Eyre is that Jane Eyre is irritable. The character is irritated by the selfishness of those who surround her. So there's a kind of standard trope in a novel, which is a good person surrounded by selfish people, and part of the way you can tell they're a good person is that they don't meet selfishness with selfishness. Jane Eyre kind of does. And it's reasonable. Her selfishness is reasonable. It's self-preservative, you could say. But it's human. It's what a decent human being under the kind of pressures that she's put under, especially by her so-called family, her aunt, who's taking care of her when she's an orphan at the start. She's irritated by these really irritating people. And it's really cool to read a novel by a narrator who's irritated, right? Does that sound fair, Eileen? Does that sound fair, Quinn? So she is a real person from the start. And it's a really interesting novel for that reason. There's a plot thing. Aurora Leigh actually has a lot of plot. I mean, you can already tell at the end of the section from book one, the section of the poem that we're reading, where she meets Romney and the relationship of Romney to her own aunt and her own aunt's attitude towards her relationship to Romney. That begins setting the plot in motion. So there's a whole lot of plot in Aurora Leigh, and the main plot device at the end, and this is, so I don't want to give you spoilers, but there's a really big thing that happens at the end of Jane Eyre, which leads to the happy ending. A very famous sentence, first sentence of a chapter,
Reader,
I married him. Is like the most famous single sentence in Jane Eyre. But the reason she marries him, what makes that possible, after he acts like a total jerk, which is to say that he is willing, I don't want to give you spoilers because it's so good, but if you've ever heard the phrase the mad woman in the attic, that's where it comes from. And he is willing to deny the existence of this person who would spoil everything. And he has an idea for a happy ending that Jane Eyre says, no, that's ridiculous. We're actually reading it and thinking, okay, yeah, you could do that. But Jane is saying, no, I'm not doing that. Was that your feeling the first time you read it?
Yeah.
Like, why make such a big deal out of this? Just do it. Come on. You're innocent. It's all on him. Do it. But she says, no, it's disgusting what he's trying to do. Then there's, yeah.
I do think you can go ahead and spoil it. It's 200 years old.
No, because really, would you have wanted it spoiled before you read it?
I read it at the end of Jane Eyre.
Reader, I married him.
Yeah,
exactly. But it's how we get there.
I also knew the plot of Pride and Prejudice before, like, you know, like, I kind of get that, what you're saying.
Yes, this is all,
but there's a big plot. There's a big plot device.
Keep it a secret. Keep it a secret.
Look, I'm even going to say, can I spoil it? And you're all going to say yes. But then one day you're going to read Jane Eyre and you're going to say, oh shit, I know what's going to happen. And that will make you unhappy. And then you'll blame Eileen. So I don't want you blamed in the future. You will feel it telepathically. At any rate, a big thing happens. And there's a really melodramatic plot moment, which is to say that it's not a realistic novel, but in a relatively realistic novel, which is to say that it's set in an environment where every day is essentially like every other day. The background isn't going to change much. It's a certain society, a certain culture, certain kinds of people, certain kinds of dogs. Because dogs are really important. One day you can get me started on the Wikipedia list of fictional dogs that I had a gigantic fight about with other people 10 years ago. But they're dogs in Jane Eyre. But the background's all the same. You know, they're the village dogs and the village people and the village servants and so on. But then something happens to, like, totally change the background. It's not that we find something out. It's that an event happens, like a balloon crossing North America. An event happens, and that changes everything. And that event, which is total plot device, you could call it, do people know the phrase jumping the shark? What's it mean? You know the phrase, but you don't know what it means?
Exactly.
Okay, so there used to be a show called Happy Days on TV, starring Henry Winkler. You know about it?
Yeah, vaguely.
Yeah, okay, vaguely. Henry Winkler, do you know who he is? He just won a Best Supporting Actor for his role in Barry. Huh. You should watch Barry. It's great. Barry is a serial killer who is mistaken for an actor. He's not a serial killer, he's a contract killer, mistaken for an actor. It's on HBO, it's really good, it's a contemporary show, they're doing another season now. Henry Winkler is the co-star, he's great. So he was on this show called Happy Days 40 years ago, 50 years ago, and ratings were plunging, so you'll actually learn something in this course. Ratings were plunging, and so they did something where he goes water skiing, they did a show where he goes water skiing, and a shark! Oh my God! So what does he have to do on his water skis? Is this dun-dun-dun-dun shark? He's got to jump over it. So that was supposed to get ratings up again, which is like this exciting, bizarre episode. But basically, it came to mean trying to save a TV show that has run its course by having some desperate plot device, introducing some desperate plot device, which is going to change everything. So that gave rise to the term jump the shark, and it means basically the show has lost its marbles because it can no longer go on in the same way that it's going on. It's no longer working. It's got to do something that's really going to get the audience's attention, but often what it does is just so out of keeping with the character of the show that it looks ridiculous, and it means the show is doomed, and that's called jumping the shark. So that's the... Now you know some technical terminology. There's a jumping the shark moment in Jane Eyre. And the same shark is jumped the same way at the end of Aurora Leigh. So it is essentially the same plot device. The same completely unexpected, unless you've read Jane Eyre. But even if you read Jane Eyre, you won't expect it. The same because, what, she's going to do the same thing that Charlotte Bronte did? Yeah, she does. So now like everyone who's read Jane Eyre, in 1853, when Aurora Leigh came out, you would also, at least, get a sense of deja vu as you read through Aurora Leigh. So some of you now know what that is, and, the rest of you should be really curious about both Jane Eyre and Aurora Leigh. Because they're both great. But that's one kind of similarity between them. So what else did people like about Barrett Browning? I'm saying Barrett Browning not to distinguish her from Robert Browning. There's Browning and then there's Barrett Browning. But because her last name, Barrett, was the family was really proud of, and there was a stipulation in the will that that name should always be part of the name of any descendant of the Barretts. So some of you may know there's a movie called The Barretts of Wimpole Street, which is about her and Robert Browning. It's a great movie. It's from starring Charles Laughton as her father. It's from like the late 40s, early 50s. It's a great movie. So her name was Elizabeth Barrett Barrett, and then when she married, it wasn't hyphenated, but it's Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Robert Browning, who was I think 6 years younger than she was, fell in love with her from her poetry, and he wrote her a letter saying, your poetry totally blows me away. It's just fantastic. Can I meet you sometime? And she was an invalid in her house,
kind of, if you know what Charles Laughton is like, you could see why he would be a perfect person for her father. Oppressed by a father who thought he knew better than anyone. Proud of his daughter because she's this really well-known poet, famous poet, great poet. But nevertheless, very, very overbearing father. And in the meantime, she's producing all these symptoms of invalidism. And so Robert Browning writes her a letter. She's world famous. He's not. And they meet, and he's already in love with her, but they fall in love for reals. And then they get married, and they move to Florence. And they spent many years in Florence, which is why Aurora Leigh starts in Florence. She's really interested in the contrast between England and Italy. And that's just one of the things that you can see scene setting wise, background wise, in the poem. So we'll talk about Robert Browning also, obviously. But at any rate, she's an amazing poet, and also I hope you feel, I hope you can get from already this much of Aurora Leigh, a very strong feminist. And that feminism is central to the whole epic. So there is a plot, there are politics in the plot. It is kind of a page-turner. There's melodrama coming up, including a shark jumping scene, but there's a lot of other melodrama that just, I don't know, water skis straight past the shark. It's a really good story, and both plot-wise and politically and psychologically, Aurora Leigh is a poet. That's the first thing we know about her as we're starting to read this story. So, okay, that's just a little bit, not a background, but of a place to start with. Yeah, so what do people like about it? Or dislike, but what do people like about it? Uses real estate well.
I mean, I can keep going.
Yeah, keep going. Go for it.
I think, like, as you said, it's an extremely feminist, like, way of looking at a character, but it's not hiding from the fact that, like, any precocious coming-of-age story, we are supposed to be aware that the kid is kind of wrong sometimes.
Uh-huh.
And, like, so as much as it's a feminist story with, like, an extremely precocious teen girl, like, we still know that she's probably going to run her mouth a little bit, and she's like probably gonna get herself into trouble thinking she's so precocious.
Okay, good. Other people? Things you liked? Yeah.
I mean, from the very beginning, that analogy that she uses, like when you paint your portrait for a friend who keeps it in a drawer and looks at it long after he has ceased to love you. Like,
yeah.
That was just such an amazing analogy.
Yeah, let's go to that. What line is that? Sorry, as I say, I don't
know. Like line five, it's right at the
Oh, point. Right. Okay, yes, yeah. Right, so I will write my story for my better self. So yeah, just look at that. Well, just go on with the analogy and then we can look at it more closely. Do you want to say more about that analogy, or is there other stuff you wanted to point to?
I was going
to
point
to
other
stuff. Okay, point to other stuff. Go for it.
And the drama that's over by line 500 on page 113, when Romney says, "You're wicked now, you wish to die and leave the world a dust for others with your naughty light blown out." I looked into his face defiantly. He might have known that being what I was, 'twas natural to like to get away as far as dead folk can, and then indeed some people make no trouble when they die. She's just like the most dramatic person coming up with these analogies that like really sit well with the mind.
Yeah, nice. And notice
speaking of fictional dogs, it's like the most anticlimactic last line.
Right.
In the entire section. Uh-huh. He shut his dog out.
Yep. He turned and went abruptly, slammed the door, and shut his dog out.
So, yeah, he's pretty pissed off if he's not even paying attention to his dog and trying to get in. Good. Yeah. Yeah, that's a strong moment. It's how many people have died so far in the poem? Yeah, who?
Malta.
Yeah, so her mother dies when she's 4. Barrett Browning's mother died when she was in her 20s, which is, but she was still living at home, which is why her father was domineering. And then her father dies. How old? So her mother dies when she's 4. How old is she when her father dies?
13.
Yeah. So, so she is raised by a father who does his best, but doesn't really know what children need and what girls need in particular, but what children need in general. And then her mother dies, and there's this aunt who is a year older than her father, who disapproves of everything so far. So all of that, I think, is just done really well. I should tell you later that she and Romney have an argument about Charles Dickens. The argument is related to the question of women's experience, girls and women's experience versus boys and men's experience. And part of it has to do with the idea that, I don't know if you're getting a sense of this yet in the poem, but it is the strong idea that poetry is for females. That we now live in a modern 19th century, STEM is the answer, or in this case, it's political science, political economy, figuring out how to help the poor, doing all your work in order to help them. All of which is true. That is, this is not something the poem is critiquing in any way. That that there's with the Industrial Revolution, there is this new phenomenon, you could call it, of urban poverty. That is to say, cities are exploding. I mean, cities have been exploding now since about 1600. But cities are exploding as sites of manufacture. So if you think of Dickens's novel Hard Times, do people know that novel at all? Is that something you weren't assigned? Okay, well, that's about, like all of Dickens's novels, it's about individuals being treated like crap by an industrial society demanding labor, industrial labor. We talked a little bit about the Thomas Hood poem, The Song of the Shirt. And Hood and Dickens were very similar to each other. And we saw that Dickens ballad. I don't know if you remember it. But Dickens is very much a leftist novelist, and he's hugely sentimental, but a whole lot of his, and he also has occasional female narrators, but a whole lot of his novels are just about think of A Christmas Carol. And think of Scrooge and what he does to the Cratchit family, right? That is, it's all about money. It's all about doing what should be done, what must be done in order for those who own the means of production to become richer and richer, and that means the oppression of the poor and... Hard Times is about going to the poorhouse if you can't work, or even if you go to the poorhouse, you have to work in order to be supported. So the modern ideas of the economic oppression of the poor as being due to the economic structure of society. Jesus very famously said, "The poor ye shall always have with you." But he didn't mean because that is the
consequence of new modes of production. It's the consequence of the rise of factories and so on. But for Dickens, it was the consequence of the rise of factories. For Marx, it's the consequence of the rise of factories. So that's what Romney Lee is interested in. And he's interested in clear-sighted attention to economic facts and to correcting them in such a way that poverty won't be inevitable, to challenge poverty. What he's not interested in is what he thinks of the sentimentality of poetry. So there's one political issue, which is the class issue, let's call it. The proletariat, to use the word always associated with Marx, versus the bourgeoisie and versus the aristocracy. And there's another political issue, which is the feminist issue, which is women being oppressed timelessly, but now in a particular way in the contemporary culture of the 19th century. And that particular way is there are important political things to do, and it's men who have to do them. So it is men who have to do the work of opposing economic oppression of current means and modes of production. And women, they're just going to want to stay with this ageless, timeless feeling for poetry, which is no longer, if it ever was, it's certainly no longer of any political efficacy. That at least is what Romney Lee thinks. And so there's so you could say that there are three sides, at least three sides in Aurora Lee. But both Aurora and Romney are, let's say, politically on the right side, what Elizabeth Barrett Browning would regard as the right side, and what most of us would probably regard as the right side, most of us in Massachusetts would regard as the right side. The side of the working class and the side of women. But there's opposition between them. The opposition being, you're going about it the wrong way, thinks Romney, if you are pushing feminism, because there are more important things, and feminism is essentially just a poetic airiness, but there's this really important material life that has to do with the economy, and the way women can help out is, well, not getting in the way or helping their men fight the good fight or something like that. And that's what Barrett Browning does not believe, and that is therefore going to be a whole lot of what the argument in Aurora Lee is going to be. There are other really important characters who are going to come along later on. So anyhow, this is just giving you a little bit of a foretaste of what's being set up here at the beginning of the poem. Okay, other moments people liked? Yeah.
I liked that line 50, that and stringing pretty words that make no sense and kissing full sense into empty words.
Yeah.
The reversals that are happening there.
Yeah, where's that?
Line 51.
Yeah.
52.
Let me just go back to it. Yeah, so women know the way to rear up children to be just. So that parentheses is pretty cool, right? So women know the way to rear up children. And then it's not just, yeah, they're good with kids, but to rear them up, parentheses, to be just. That is, rear up children who are going to end up how? In a political context. Is there there's a possible ambiguity in the to be just. So how do you read that? Just why that parentheses? Sorry, I shouldn't have said there was a possible ambiguity. How do you read? But that's always a good thing. When someone tells you there's a possible ambiguity, it means your interpretation is one possibility. So that should actually make things easier. I'm not asking you what the ambiguity is. I'm just asking you, how do you read it? Yeah?
I think I have the ambiguity wrong, but I thought of it as this is that to be just is either the way to bring up, to rear up children, or it's one of those kind of whispered parentheticals where you're like, to be sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me be just about women. Women know how to raise up children. I have to concede that women know how to raise up children. So that's one possibility. The person conceding that, though, would say of herself that she is just, because most people who are giving accounts of themselves think that that account will justify themselves. Otherwise, why would you do it? So the person who is telling this, who is making this claim, is making a claim that she thinks is truthful. And therefore, to be just means let me concede. Let's say that's one meaning. But the reason you would concede something is that you think of yourself as a just person, or you're presenting yourself as a just person. So, to be just, the former president did do Operation Warp Speed for vaccines. And then after that, he started saying, don't wear masks. You shouldn't get vaccinated. Yeah. What?
I would just say inject bleach.
Inject bleach, But to be just, Operation Warp Speed was pretty impressive. So why would I say that? Because I am trying to be just in by conceding that it's not all terrible. It may be mostly terrible, but it's not all terrible. But why would I want to do that? Why wouldn't I just lie, Tucker Carlson, who acknowledges under oath that he's a liar, but otherwise won't? Because I actually, it's not only a speech act of concession. Do people know the term speech act? So, okay, you should know it. This is just really important for philosophy of language as well as for literature. So here is a two-minute spiel on speech acts. Around the mid-20th century, a philosopher named Austin with an I, not with an E, J.L. Austin, said, there are lots of things that looks like sentences describe how things are, like the phone is on the table, the sky is cloudy, description of the world. But in fact, there are lots of sentences that have the grammatical form of a description of the world, of a fact, but are not facts, but are acts. And a standard example of that would be, and I think it's the first one he starts with, is if you say, I do at a wedding. So when you say, I do, you're not only saying, yes, it is a fact that I take this person to be my lawfully wedded spouse, blah, blah, blah. It's not simply a fact. It's saying I do is an act which makes that person my spouse. Another example would be, another early example he gives is, if you christen a ship, if you say, I hereby christen this ship, the President Trump, then it's not the case that you are describing something that would be true whether you said it or not. The way it's cloudy outside is true whether I say it or not. It's in saying, I christened this ship, the President Trump, that you are actually doing what you seem to be describing. So it's got the form of a description, but it's not just the form of a description, it's an actual act. So obvious examples of speech acts that Austin starts with are, I bet, when you make a wager. So I bet $500 on this. And by saying I bet $500, you're not describing something, you're actually doing it. Or I promise that I will get the paper in tomorrow. You're not saying, here's a fact in the world which would be true whether I said I promise or not. By saying I promise, you're doing it. Or I warn you, and so on. So speech acts are things that look like they're simply describing how things are, but they are actually causing them to be. And the more you think about it, this is what Austin thought about a lot, the more it turns out that actually most of our sentences are speech acts and not simply descriptions. An example that he gives, a really crucial example, and then I'll stop with that, but a crucial example he gives, is if you say, I know something, that has the structure not of a description but of a promise. If you say, I know that Trump colluded with the Russians, it's not a fact that Trump colluded with the Russians and you know that fact, although that's what it sounds like, but you're actually making a promise to the person that you are speaking to, saying, I promise you that this will turn out to be the case. And if it doesn't, you are entitled to say, I broke my promise. So if you say you know something and it turns out to be false, then it's a promise that you've broken rather than a mistake that you've made. Whereas if you say, I'm certain that Trump colluded with the Russians, then that could be a mistake. You're certain, but you were wrong. But someone can't say, you said you knew, and you turned out to be lying. If you say, I'm certain, you're not lying. So speech acts are really crucial to a whole lot of our everyday conversation. Yeah.
I'm a little bit confused about, so a speech act makes it happen in the moment, such as, like, if say the queen is knighting someone,
right,
like
good.
I dub thee a knight,
yes.
would be an example of mm-hmm. this. However, if you say, I know, or like, if you say, like, oh, I know I'll be home at 5,
uh-huh.
but then you get home at 7,
yeah.
that's not making anything actual when you say it.
Yeah. So I'll be home at 5 is different from I know I'll be home at 5. So if you say, or something like, I know she's home, someone is entitled to say, wait a second, you said you knew she was home, it turned out she wasn't home. Why did you say that? And so if you say, I'm certain that she's home, someone isn't going to, and then it turns out she's not at home, someone isn't going to say, how dare you have said you were certain? They might say, you know, you trusted yourself too much, but they're not going to, it doesn't have the same feel of a lie, even an unintentional lie, but a lie that I know she's home does. One of the ways that Austin describes this is to say that when people say, I know something, a question you can ask them is, how do you know? Whereas if they say, I'm certain of something, they will say, why are you certain? So those are different questions. How is conceding that you do know it? And the idea of knowledge is if you say you know something, you are saying it is the case. There can be no question because I know that it's the case. One of the things Kierkegaard, I can't believe we're going so off tangent, but this is partly about philosophy. Kierkegaard said, how can you say there is no God when I know that I am saved? And so his argument is, he knows something, and if you know something, it has to be true. I know that it's not 3:30 yet. That means it has to be true that it's not 3:30 yet. If I say, I'm certain that we'll start class on time on Wednesday, and then that doesn't mean we will. It means that I intend for us to do so, I won't forget my computer then and so on.
I'm certain that it's going to work out. But that's reassurance rather than an assertion of unshakable truth. So the basic idea is, if you know you can't be wrong, that is the claim that you make when you say you know something. If you know you can't be wrong. I'm not sure that Johnny ate all the marshmallows. Well, I don't care if you're not sure. I know that he did. I saw him. I'm not sure Johnny ate all the marshmallows. Well, so you're not sure, so what? I'm certain that he did. Okay, that's a difference of opinion. But I know that he did is playing a trump card. Does that make sense? So at any rate, look for, it's always an interesting thing to do to look for speech acts in sentences that at first blush seem to be simple statements of fact. There are very few sentences that are simple statements of fact. And often they look like it, but there are very few that are. So here is, the point is, here's a speech act, to be just. So the speech act, as in Austin in that parentheses, is I hereby declare that I am doing justice to someone I might not otherwise be inclined to do that much justice to. So to be just, Trump did do Operation Warp Speed. To be just, women know the way to rear up children. But what proves that? What proves that my that I'm entitled to the speech act of saying this is justice, to acknowledge that is justice. I acknowledge that women know how to raise up children. What proves it is that women have raised up children to be just persons. And as a just person, I credit my mother and I credit the women who raised me up, however they did it, for raising me up to be just. So there's a kind of virtuous circle there, or a good circle, which is the very fact that I'm trying to be just shows that I was raised right. So I have to acknowledge that I was raised right, and what shows that I was raised right is that I have to acknowledge that I was raised right in a way that other people might not. Yeah, I was raised right, but I don't care. I hate my parents. And I'm never going to say anything nice to them, nice about them. But that's not what she's doing. Okay, does that make sense? I don't. this is a whole lot of time on three words, but it's kind of typical of just the amazingly I don't want to say light touch, but graceful touch that Barrett Browning has. That is, she is just so good at saying what she wants to say in any phrase, in any line, in any set of words. And so that's just a micro example of that. Okay, let's just go back to the beginning, just to see what's going on there. Of writing many books, there is no end. That's a famous tagline. That's not originally hers. I think it actually might go all the way back to Ecclesiastes, but of writing many books, there is no end. And I, who have written much in prose and verse for others' uses, will write now for mine. So the first thing we find out is she's a writer. She's published a lot. I, who have written much in prose and verse for others' uses, will write now for mine. Did you think that was Barrett Browning, or did you think that was Aurora Leigh speaking when you first read it?
When I first read it, I thought it was Barrett Browning, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does look like something the classical poets would do.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. It's the beginning of Paradise Lost, is Milton saying, here I am coming to justify the ways of God to men. It is the beginning of the Prelude, which had just come out in 1850, was the first time that most people read the Prelude. So Wordsworth has this amazing autobiographical poem, the Prelude. It's a philosophical poem, and it's a self-analysis. And he didn't publish it in his lifetime. He wrote it 45 years earlier. He finished a version of it in 1805. But it was supposed to be the preface to a much longer philosophical work that he was working on, which the parts that are finished are sufficiently bad that we may be grateful that he didn't finish the whole thing. And the Prelude is a preamble to that poem. It's an epic length poem on the growth of his own mind, and it's about himself. And it begins, there's a blessing in this gentle breeze, and he's talking about how he's now ready to sit down and write this poem. And it's a poem in which he does a kind of self-analysis of what it's like to be a certain kind of person who grows up in nature, who goes to the city, who lives a certain kind of way, whose parents die when he's very young. All of this hugely influential when it came out right after he died in 1850. And among the people that it influences is Barrett Browning. Robert Browning has a poem about Wordsworth that we'll look at called The Lost Leader, in which he talks about how great Wordsworth was until he became, he lost all his idealism and became the very conservative, crusty old fart that he was for the last 45 years of his life. And Yeats later says the young poet should think of Wordsworth withering into 80, which is how old Wordsworth was when he died. Everyone hated what became of Wordsworth, and Robert Browning wrote about that. But then this poem came out right after Wordsworth died, The Prelude, as it was called. He always called it the poem on the growth of my own mind. And that's one of the things that Barrett Browning is responding to in Aurora Leigh. So, yeah, at first it looks like, you know, she's a famous poet at this point, really famous at this point. And so it looks like it's autobiographical, but then that morphs into the story of Aurora Leigh. But that morphing is also telling you, yeah, there's a whole lot about their characters that is similar. The character of Aurora Leigh and the character of Elizabeth Barrett Browning, they're similar characters. So of writing many books, there is no end. And I, who have written much in prose and verse for others' uses, will write now for mine. So she's writing for her own use. Will write my story for my better self. As when you paint your portrait for a friend who keeps it in a drawer and looks at it long after he has ceased to love you, just to hold together what he was and is. So her better self, follow the parallels, her better self no longer does what? It's an odd little description here. Odd little bit of self reference. So how do things line up? Who's the friend in the parallel? Yeah.
It's a friend to herself. It's like a time capsule that she's writing for herself.
Okay, so she's writing for her better self, right? And her better self is not the writer writing, but the self that will read what she's writing. So the better self lines up with the friend, right? So as when you paint your portrait for a friend who keeps, I will write my story for my better self, as when you paint your portrait for a friend who keeps it in a drawer and looks at it long after he has ceased to love you. So, but when do you paint the portrait? Is it after the friend has ceased to love you or while the friend still loves you? So just unpack what she's saying here. I mean, you were right to seize on that as a really interesting moment just at the very start. Unpack it. What's the simile? As when you paint your portrait for a friend, have we all done that? No. It's not, I think, a simile that most people will say, oh, yeah, like when you do that. You know, it's not like, well, you know what it's like when you really have to figure something out on your phone quickly, but, oh, no, it requires that you re-enter your password, right? We've all been there. But this is not a place we've all been. So it's an interesting simile because it's not like, oh, yeah, it's when you're looking for your shoes in the morning, but you forgot that they were wet and you left them outside and now they're even wetter. You know, it's not an experience we've all had. But she's treating it as though it is because she uses the you as when you paint your portrait for a friend.
So it also wouldn't have been...
Sorry?
It also would not have been commonplace for...
No, it's not a thing that people were always doing, saying, well, you're my friend. Here's my portrait so that you can keep it in a drawer and look at it long after you have ceased to love me. It's, you know, everyday kind of thing.
That's not something my ex would say, actually.
Oh, great. But what's the temporal scheme here? That is, so I'm painting my portrait here, is essentially what she's saying, right? That's the simile. I'm going to write for my own use. I'll write my story for my better self, as when you paint your portrait for a friend who keeps it in a drawer and looks at it long after he has ceased to love you. So, just in the simile, when do you paint that portrait for your friend? So, there are two times. There's the time your friend loved you, and then there's the time when he no longer loves you, right? Two different temporal possibilities. No longer loves you means that he did. When he ceased to love you means he did love you. Okay, so there are two times. In which of those two time periods are you painting the portrait?
When he still does.
When he still loves you. So you paint your portrait for your friend while he loves you with the result that he can what?
One day he will cease to love you, but he will still look at the picture.
Okay. So he keeps it in a drawer and one day he'll look at the picture long after he has ceased to love you. So, okay. Good. One possibility. What's the other possibility? See, ambiguity here. You can give both readings. Yeah?
That the friend won't stop loving you, but will always have like the portrait as a reminder. Like, there isn't necessarily the end of love?
Well, long after he ceased to love you, sounds like it is. Yeah?
So, long after he ceased to love you, we'll pull this portrait out of the drawer and remember a better version of you.
Yeah, so notice what happens to the friend. It's actually psychologically quite acute and unexpected that if you just pay attention to the friend, he looks at the... Well, there might be ambiguity here too, but just notice it because she's so subtle and so good at combining... what one sees in oneself with what one sees in another person to whom one is or with whom one is interacting with and whose interactions with you are interactions you can read, but what you're reading is the way they're reading you. So a way of putting this is to say that she is really, really, really good at using the pronoun you in a casual way. That is, you won't really find in
pre-19th century poetry, this use of the exemplary you. That is, it's what we do every day is like, you know what it's like when you're coming across campus and there's a person you really don't want to meet, but it's raining, so you have to go through Usedan, and they're doing the same thing going the other way. You know what that's like. Right, do you? Okay, I thought so. So you're saying it's happened to me, but I'm generalizing to say that it happens to everyone, but I'm also specifying to say that you in particular, the person I'm mentioning this to, would know what it's like too. And when I say you know what it's like when you're walking through Usedan, I'm saying it's what it's like when I'm walking through Usedan, that you refers first of all to me, but it's to me having an experience that you, first of all, you singular, are also very likely to have had. But I can also generalize it and say it's true for everyone. So that's that use of you that we use every day, right? You know how you used you that way? See what I did there? Okay. So that's what she's doing. She's using you in a way that it can refer to her, Aurora Lee, or it can refer to the reader, or it can refer to everyone. And that leads, I'm not going to say, the problem with the word ambiguity, the way it's often used, is a famous example is John D. Rockefeller was famously cheap. And he sent someone to England to buy some stock for him and said, you know, it's going to go for £3 a share, so buy it at £3 a share. And because I really want this stock. So the agent goes to England and no, the stock is now going for £4 a share. So he sends a telegram to John D. Rockefeller and says, it's £4 a share. Should I buy it? Now, John D. Rockefeller is famously cheap, so he doesn't want to waste a lot of money on a telegram. So he simply telegraphs back four words, which are no price too high. So that's an ambiguity, right? It's either no price too high or there is no price that could be too high. Buy it under any circumstances. So the ambiguity there is it's either A or B, but it's not both. But the kind of ambiguity in to be just, or what I was calling ambiguity, the kind of ambiguity that you often get in a you phrase is that it's both and rather than either or. It's two or more things that can all be simultaneously true rather than if A is true, then B is false. If B is true, then A is false. So that's the kind of thing that she is really good at. So just here, I'm now going to write for mine. I have written much in prose and verse rather than uses. We'll write now for mine. We'll write my story for my better self as when you paint your portrait for a friend who keeps it in a drawer and looks at it long after he has ceased to love you, just to hold together what he was and is. So, okay, what do you make of those 11 syllables? Just to hold together what he was and is. Yeah.
I think if we take every single word is so important in that line, so just to signals that there's only one interpretation or one motivation.
Good, nice, nice, good.
Hold together, not remember, not admire, not recollect, hold together, which could mean to get a grip or to make some sort of a connection to piece two things in a single unit.
Uh-huh.
What, not who, what.
Nice.
He was and is.
Uh-huh.
As in two separate things.
Okay, good. So to hold together what he was, to hold that together with what he is. To keep those things connected to each other. Or to compare them. Because you can hold two things together, not as in keep them together because they're flying apart, but look at them simultaneously. Look at this and now look at this at the same time and look at how things have changed. So again, there's even an ambiguity there. But yeah, that was great going through it one word at a time like that. So looking at what he was, looking at what he is, holding them together just so that he can do it. So we have an infinitive form just to hold together what he was and is. So someone does something just to ... what's the thing that's done just for that to be possible?
Keeps it in his drawer and looks at it.
Okay, so he keeps it in his drawer and looks at it because he wants to hold together what he was and is. What's another possibility? Just grammatically.
So he ceased to love you in order to hold together what he was and is.
Okay, nice. So he keeps it in a drawer to hold it and looks at it to hold together what he was and is, or he keeps it in a drawer and looks at it long after he has ceased to love you just to hold together what he was and is. So he's ceasing to love you so that he can see the advance that he's made. Okay, one other possibility.
She's painting the portrait to hold together what he was and is.
Or to give to him so that when he ceases to love her, he will nevertheless have this portrait, which will, which is her holding together what he was and is. So it could be him doing the holding together. It could be her doing the holding together. And when do you paint your portrait for a friend? When he loves you or when he ceases to love you?
When he loves you.
So, as when you paint your portrait for a friend, okay, who keeps it in a drawer and looks at it long after he ceased to love you, just altogether what he was and is. So all that could be parenthetical, is what you're saying. So you could just skip that if you were doing the Reader's Digest condensed version of this poem. It's as when you paint your portrait for a friend. And then I gotta admit that your friend puts it in a drawer and looks at it long after he ceased to love you, just altogether what he was and is. But I'm just writing this for my better self the way you paint a portrait for a friend. So if you skip those three lines, the idea would be on that reading, you're not losing anything essential. As when you paint your portrait for a friend, period. You don't need the next three lines. I'm writing this for my better self as when you paint your portrait for a friend. So why does she put those three lines in then? Yeah.
To add more emotional emphasis for writing towards the better half.
Okay, say more. That's good, I like that.
Self, or at least what I would interpret as the better self, is the person, once the storm is rolled through, once the storm is ended, the person that comes out on the other end as the better person for coming through all that hardship.
Yeah. Okay. So compare that to painting the portrait for a friend. I guess, let me just put the cards on the table. Yeah, go.
I guess the thought of regret shows up because writing something for your better self means that you're going to move past something with no regrets left behind versus when you look at the photo, you're going to feel regret or perhaps guilt in that maybe the person in the photo was hurt because of something you did because you were unwilling to accept.
Okay, good. So here's the possibility then for the ambiguity. One is you just paint a portrait for a friend. People do that. it's a standard movie trope, let's say. Hell, let's get our photos taken. We're climbing to the top of the Empire State Building and they're going to give us a free photo. Or not a free photo, it's going to cost $20. And so you do it because it's all fun, and then cut to 5 years later, and the person you're doing it with is looking at the photo and feeling, you know, nostalgia and regret or whatever, or you're thinking about this photo and thinking, I wonder if that person is looking at the photo and how they feel. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is something like this. Everything goes wrong. Here's my portrait. You love me now. Here's my portrait. Put it in a drawer. And sometime after we've broken up, just take a look at it. You'll want to look at it and compare yourself, your future self then, to your present self now. So you can imagine that as, I think you can imagine that in certain kinds of sad stories or movies. That is, we're happy now. There's a great Doonesbury cartoon where two people are getting married and Doonesbury and a friend are watching them come out of the church and they're saying, look at them. It's the happiest day of their lives. From here on, it's all downhill. They're going to look back at this with nostalgia but also regret and wondering if they did the right thing because this is just the happiest day of their lives. And the bride and groom are walking past them and hear this. And then the groom turns to the bride and says, well, so much for the happiest day of our life. That is the anticipation of how it's not going to be like this in the future. It's your wedding day. That's great. It's not going to be like this in the future. So you can imagine stories in which, you know, the smart, deep, melancholy hero or heroine says, we're so in love now. Look, here's my portrait. And sometime in the future, look at it and remember our happiness now, and compare yourself then to now. Yeah.
And she's saying this to us, the reader.
Yeah.
It's so, I just love her character because it's so presumptuous.
Yes.
You're going to love me so much, and you're going to think I'm so smart and so pretty, but just you wait, because I'm going to blah.
Yeah, okay, good. Nice, yes, definitely doing that. But notice that she's also doing it for her own future self. So I will write my story for my better self, that is my future self, who will compare the portrait. So I guess the thing to say, and I don't even know why I'm going into such detail here, except that it gives you a sense of the psychological complexity of what she's doing from the get-go, is it's as though there are three times or even four time periods that she's describing. There's her past, which has led to what she is in the present, which leads to her doing something for her future self. So her present tense self is looking at her past in order to do something for her future self. So that's three different time periods. While knowing that the future self is going to look back at the past differently from the way she looks at it right now. So it's like there are four different temporal perspectives here. And that's a whole lot of what the poem is about, is that she has to deal with lots of mistakes that she makes, lots of judgments that she makes that turn out to be wrong. But also lots of the dealing with it, the kind of self-analysis that she does is really pretty amazing. Okay, so just really quickly, let me just say what happens in the poem. We'll go back to this on Wednesday. But what happens in the poem is that the idea, just to repeat myself a little bit, the idea that poetry is the woman's domain, that it's the 19th century after all, and men are creating this new economy and doing cruel things in order to have economic expansion, and literary men like Dickens are writing realistic novels about what's going on. They may be sentimental, but their description of the world of the new economy is realistic. And poetry is just so pre-19th century. And the pre-19th century aspect of it can be seen in the idea that it's women's work, that it's women who write poetry. And men, when they use literature to try to intervene politically, they do the smart thing and write novels. So that is the opening gambit, let's say, of Aurora Leigh. What makes it a really great feminist, it's an epic length poem, what makes it novel length poem is what makes it a really great feminist work is that it is saying, no, poetry, which men seem to have dropped, is as politically important as anything and any other literary mode. And that is what she is pushing really hard. Okay, see you Wednesday. And thank you for these.